Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
NSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations with Jeff Stein and Gene Meserve.
Welcome to Spy Talk. I'm Gene Meserve. Jeff Stein is taking a well-deserved week off. Three former generals have created a hubbub with their Washington Post op-ed expressing their fear that there could be a coup after the next election because the big lie has eroded faith in our electoral system.
And if you have a reasonable young man or woman who now believes that we have doubt in who the real elected president of the United States is, who has doubt that we have made an accurate call, who believes there may be fraud in the electoral outcome, that doubt will be a significant problem for the country, for our federal police forces, for all of our state and local police forces, and by extrapolation, the U.S. military.
I'll be talking more with retired General Paul Eaton later in the podcast about the potential for a partisan breakdown in the U.S. military. But first, Ukraine. Ukraine's Ministry of Defense estimates there are 120,000 Russian troops massed on its border, although Russia says it has returned 10,000 of them to their permanent bases, and diplomatic talks have been scheduled for early January, fears of a Russian invasion in the new year are unabated. In a recent interview with CBS News, Vice President Kamala Harris said if Russian troops do enter Ukraine, there will be severe consequences.
We are very clear that Russia should not invade the sovereignty of Ukraine, that we must stand up, and we are standing up for its territorial integrity. We are working with our allies in that regard, and we've been very clear that we are prepared to issue sanctions like you've not seen before.
Does that mean sanctioning Vladimir Putin directly?
I am not going to talk about specific sanctions, but we are making that clear to him, and we are in direct conversations.
Russian President Vladimir Putin denies he's planning to invade, but is insisting on a pledge from NATO that it will not expand to the east and will not allow Ukraine to join.
You must give us the guarantees. It is up to you, and you must do this immediately, right now.
Jonathan Broder, a Spy Talk contributing editor, has been covering wars and writing about foreign policy for four decades. In a recent Spy Talk piece, he called the Ukraine situation the most dangerous confrontation between the United States and Russia since the collapse of the Soviet Union 30 years ago. Jeff Stein caught up with Broder last week to discuss the deepening crisis.
Jonathan Broder, welcome to Spy Talk. Great to have you back again. You wrote a fascinating piece for us about the U.S.-Ukraine-Russia situation. Let's get right to it. What does Putin want? And how is he going to get it?
Putin wants the NATO and the United States to back off in its movement of NATO to the east. And what he's done is he's massed some 100,000 troops on the border of Ukraine, threatening an invasion, clearly. And this, I believe, is an effort to get the United States and NATO to consider his demands. And his demands are that NATO and the United States have to provide him with guarantees that Ukraine will never join NATO, and that the countries that are already in NATO, that are in Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics, will not have missiles based at them aimed at Russia. And he would also like to revive the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty, the INF treaty, which Trump withdrew from several years ago.
But as you noted in your piece, John, there's no appetite in NATO to include Ukraine as a NATO member. So what's going on?
Well, I think that Putin doesn't really trust that. There has been a standing invitation for Ukraine and the former Soviet Republic of Georgia to join NATO since 2008. And that invitation was reiterated by Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, just last week. So as far as Putin is concerned, that offer is still on the table. And somewhere down the line, it's possible that Ukraine could meet NATO's conditions and join the defense alliance. So he wants to nip that in the bud right now.
But he's a nasty guy. He's been meddling in European affairs and our affairs for some time now. Is this a ploy on his part? And does he have any back off room?
When you say a ploy, you mean the mounting of the troops?
Yeah, by just threatening, you know, by massive mobilization of not just troops, but artillery pieces and so on, tanks and so on. Is this likely to have a positive effect in the West? It seems to be getting just exactly the opposite response.
Well, we don't know yet. I don't think it's a ploy. I don't think it's a ploy at all. I think that Putin considers the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO a bridge too far. You have to remember that, let's do sort of recall a bit of history here. In 1990, just after the Berlin Wall fell, there were negotiations between the United States and Russia over the reunification of Germany. And in those negotiations, one of Mikhail Gorbachev's concerns was if Germany is reunited, it will join NATO, and NATO will then hence move farther east toward Russia. And Russia has a very, very bad memory of invasions into Russia from the West. In 1812, Napoleon reached the gates of Moscow before the Soviet, the Russian winter defeated him. In 1854, Britain, France, Sardinia, and the Ottoman Empire invaded Russia from the West in the Crimean War, and Russia lost that war. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in 1941, Hitler's armies came within 10 miles of Moscow before the winter also defeated them and a very stiff Russian resistance. And in the process, in World War II, which is the most recent memory, 27 million Russians died, both soldiers and civilians. I want to repeat that number. 27 million people died. Mm-hmm. And the Russians remembered that. They remember that very, very, very carefully, very, very closely. Okay, Putin is, yes, he's a dictator. But in this case, I believe that he is concerned, just as many Russians before him have been concerned, both communists and czars, about an invasion from the West. Now, every time a country joins NATO, we base missiles there. We base troops there. And if you look at the promises that were made in 1990, James Baker, not only James Baker, but the leaders of Britain and West Germany at the time, they all promised Gorbachev in writing. A lot of people say it wasn't in writing. It was in writing. We have the documents at the National Security Archive to prove it, that they wrote in, they promised him that Baker used the words not one inch, that NATO would not move one inch eastward. Mm-hmm. And those promises have all been broken. because that was in 1990. Clinton came into power, and with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, we were the hyperpower. There was no other power to challenge us. So we did what we wanted, and we moved NATO to the east.
Mm-hmm. So there's,
and Russia could do nothing about it.
So the DNA is deeply embedded in the Russian psyche of a fear of invasion from the West. Now,
absolutely.
Also during the Clinton administration, 1994, under the so-called Budapest Accords, the U.S. and the West said it would protect Ukraine's sovereignty. And some commentators today have been writing to me and saying, well, we have a de facto pledge to Ukraine to defend them. So, and these same commentators seem to be saying, because of that, we should make a pledge to militarily defend Ukraine. What do you think about that?
That is insanity. I mean, if we do that, I would think that there's going to be war. I mean, I think that the massive buildup of Russian troops and Russian armor on the border with Ukraine is not a bluff. We've threatened sanctions. Biden has said very clearly that he will not send U.S. troops. So that's a signal right there. Mm-hmm. He has said that we will send military equipment, but so a Russian invasion of Ukraine would be costly for Russia. However, you have to weigh, I mean, I think what Putin is weighing in his mind is Russian casualties versus NATO missiles in Ukraine pointed right at Russia. And you have to remember also that if you look at a map, Ukraine sort of protrudes into the belly of Russia in the south. In the north, you have three Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, which were former Soviet republics, okay? They are also members now of NATO. So NATO has really moved into Russian territory, or former Soviet territory. Mm-hmm. Now, you put missiles in both of those countries, and Russia is hemmed in from the north and the south. I'd like to make one other point that I think is quite cogent here.
Okay.
One of the things that one hears from hawks on this issue is that Putin does not deserve to have a sphere of influence, a sort of a buffer around the western side of Russia to protect him from advances by the West toward Russia. He doesn't deserve a sphere of influence. Let's remember that if the United States is bordered by Canada and Mexico, if either of those two countries were to form a military alliance, and that's what NATO is, it's a defense alliance. If either of those two countries were to form a military alliance with either Russia or China, do you think the United States would accept that? Look what happened in 1962 when the Russians put missiles in Cuba. We nearly went to nuclear war, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Look what happened during the Cold War. All the countries of South America and Central America, that there was a threat of them going communist. We supported savage dictatorships to prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm. But another issue, another critique that has been popping up online since we published your piece, is that backing off, accepting Putin's arguments would be like 1938 all over again, with Neville Chamberlain appeasing Hitler and backing off. What do you say to that?
I don't think that Vladimir Putin is Adolf Hitler. I really don't think so. I think that he wants to, the accusation is Putin wants to reconstruct the Soviet Union. I don't think that's true. I think Putin simply wants to make sure that he has friendly governments to the west of Moscow, in between Moscow and NATO.
Okay, so
that doesn't seem to me such a unreasonable expectation. Now, you know, we may disagree with it, but I don't think that what he is doing is anything that any other Russian leader wouldn't want to do, provided that they have the strength to do it. When we moved NATO to the east in the 90s and the early 2000s, before Putin came into power, the president of Russia was Boris Yeltsin, and he was weak, and he his economy had collapsed, and he was a drunk. He couldn't do anything about it, which is why we did it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's do something about it.
Let me get you to clarify what your position is here. You're not saying, are you, that Russia is justified in overrunning at least the disputed territories and stealing them from Ukraine, military invasion? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that what he's doing is understandable. That's all. I am surprised that people don't understand that he would react this way. Of course he would. Just as we would, and as we did in 1962. And if Canada or Mexico decided to form a military alliance with China or Russia, we would not tolerate that.
All right.
Does that make us, you know, the equivalent of Hitler?
So are we Khrushchev in this situation in 1962 that we should back off Ukraine because Russia is paranoid about our or rightfully fearful of Western advances in Ukraine?
Look, there is an agreement right now, the Minsk agreements 1 and 2. And what they call for is basically splitting the baby, giving the Eastern Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine autonomy. Now, Putin has turned that down because he doesn't trust the West to make the other part, the Western part of Ukraine, neutral. Because let's say the Donbass and the other two southern and eastern provinces of Ukraine become autonomous and they are pro-Russian. That still leaves Western Ukraine, which still protrudes pretty far eastern into the underbelly of Russia, open to join NATO, and missiles could come in there too. He wants Ukraine to be neutral, all of it, east and west.
Hmm.
So, and that doesn't strike me as an unreasonable demand.
So if he seizes the eastern half of Ukraine or eastern third of Ukraine, one can foresee the West and the U.S. immediately inviting the remainder of Ukraine proper, into NATO.
Maybe not immediately, because to join NATO, you still have to jump through certain hoops, and corruption or lack of corruption would be one of them. And Western Ukraine, the Kiev government, has a corruption problem. So they would have to resolve that first.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, eventually I could see Western Ukraine becoming part of NATO.
Hmm. Now, we ran another piece yesterday, as you know, in which Dmitry Alperovitz made a very strong case that, in fact, Putin will invade in late January, early February, and that the West can do nothing about it militarily. I don't think there's any debate over that. We can make it more painful to them with Stinger missiles, say, which can take their armed choppers out of the sky, anti-tank weapons. We can bloody their nose, but there's really no question that they can overrun Ukraine, maybe even the whole of Ukraine if they were to go that far, without us being able to do anything about it militarily. So what do you think is the U.S. strategy now for responding to that kind of invasion?
One word, sanctions. That's our weapon of choice now. I mean, it seems that our foreign policy has devolved into a binary choice between military action or sanctions. And after 20 years of war in Afghanistan and a dozen or more years of war in Iraq, the United States is war weary. The administration is war weary. We're not going to go to war again over this.
But, you know, I'm glad you brought up Iraq and Afghanistan, because you can see the U.S. is also sort of crouched in a corner right now because of the calamity in Afghanistan in particular, and the threat of China, which is being magnified here into our domestic politics and so on. And so you can see us slipping into a very a dark place where we're looking into an abyss of nuclear threats and nuclear war. Can you see that happening?
Look, I can see that the United States, in the wake of Afghanistan, its credibility has suffered. Not only Russia and China, but even our European allies have lost a certain degree of faith in our credibility. And what's happening is that they are all, both rivals and allies, are going their own way. They're gonna do what they're going to do to protect their own interests, hopefully with us if they're allies, but without us if they have to. And the perfect example, and this may never happen, but that's the European talk of the creation of a European army. Now, this is
a European independent army.
A European army that is independent of the United States. And the reason why, and the country and the person who's pushing this the hardest is Emmanuel Macron, the president of France. And the reason why is that he foresees situations, particularly in the Sahel and in the Middle East, where there are big French and European interests, where the United States doesn't have interests, where there could be a crisis, a takeover by Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, or Islamic State, essentially, you know, jihadis taking over these weak governments in the Sahel and West Africa, where Europeans would have to be extracted, European interests would have to be protected, and the Americans are going to say, no, that's not our fight. Mm-hmm. So they need their own force to intervene if required. Mm-hmm. And there's serious talk about this. And what's very interesting is that up until now, the United States has been against this idea because they fear that it would weaken NATO. Biden is in favor of it. And that's a big change. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's not going to be an independent European army to rush into Ukraine to defend it against the Russians.
No, absolutely not.
So in the meantime, we're going to be in the shadowy area of covert diplomacy between both sides, or clandestine, I should say, diplomacy. What do you think is the best outcome we can look forward to in the winter?
A Russian invasion that costs Russia a lot of lives and a lot of treasure. But just remember one thing. What will happen if there is an invasion is that gas supplies to Europe will be cut off. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline project will stop dead in its tracks. So one would think that a huge source of income from Europe to pay for Russian gas will be gone, and Russia's economy, which is already kind of sputtering, will be hurt even further. But don't forget one thing. There is a huge market for Russian gas to the east, to China. And Russia and China are growing ever closer. So what I see happening is a bigger chasm between the West and Russia, and Russia getting even closer to China.
Whichever, a lot of unknowns. One thing seems to be certain, that Ukraine faces a long and lonely and cold winter.
I would agree with that.
Nothing to be happy about.
Yeah.
Jonathan Broder, always great to talk to you. You always bring an interesting viewpoint into the discussions. I want our listeners to know that they can read Jonathan Broder's work over Spy Talk on Substack. That's substack.co. Thanks, John. We'll be talking again soon.
Good talking to you, John.
That was Jonathan Broder, Spy Talk contributing editor and longtime foreign policy reporter. A reminder, you can find Jonathan Broder's reporting on Ukraine, the Middle East, and more on Substack if you subscribe to Spy Talk. And of course, we'd love to have you subscribe to the Spy Talk podcast as well. And a quick ask, on our show page, you'll find a PodTrack survey. If you could complete that, it would be great. It's a way for us to learn more about who is listening. In just a minute, could partisanship in the military lead to chaos and even a coup? Three former generals recently penned an op-ed in the Washington Post headlined, "The Military Must Prepare for a 2024 Insurrection." It warns that there's the potential for a total breakdown of the chain of command along partisan lines, citing three events. The number of active duty and former military involved in the events of January 6th, a letter released by 124 retired military officials questioning the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election, and the refusal by the commander of the Oklahoma National Guard to obey an order from President Biden that all troops be vaccinated against COVID. I spoke with one of the three authors of the op-ed, retired U.S. Army Major General Paul D. Eaton.
There is an infection perpetrated by the Republican Party in greater America. This Stop the Steal, this case that the election was fraudulent. When you say that often enough, there is the real possibility of infecting the armed forces of the United States with this cult of Trump. And I don't think that we need to settle down on percentages of extremist membership, rather cult of Trump membership.
What are your political opinions?
I am steadfast as an independent. I was a very reliable Republican voter up until halfway through President George W. Bush's second term. And for reasons related to foreign policy decisions, I became a little bit left of center in my support of various candidates.
Is it appropriate for you to speak out? Traditionally, the military has been viewed as apolitical.
Indeed. I don't consider myself to be political. I consider myself required to never walk past a mistake. Back in 2006, you may remember the so-called Revolt of the Generals, or as some would put it, the Revolting Generals. And a handful of us were very critical of Mr. Rumsfeld. I wrote an op-ed that showed up in the New York Times on the third anniversary of the attack into Iraq. So that was viewed as a political event. And in fact, I became the darling of the left. But it was not a political event. It was an assessment for the performance of the serving Secretary of Defense that nobody seemed willing to do.
Is this, what you've written now, is this a political event?
It is not. It can be certainly construed to be a political event because the problem is the Republican Party. The problem, There are so few reasonable Republicans left who have not fallen into the trap of Trump that that is a danger to the American democracy.
But do you think that this kind of political statement, not just from yourself, but also from those others who signed a letter in support of the big lie, do you think that contributes to the recent survey results from the Reagan Institute, which showed that in the last 3 years, trust in the military has dropped from 70% to 45%?
Well, there are, you know, there factors bearing on the problem, and there are quite a lot of them. But the and we can look at how we prosecuted the last wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the outcomes therein. Is that a contributing factor? I don't know. But I am uncomfortable with the current state of affairs where retired military are taking a political stance.
But again, you're doing it. But you're doing it.
No, I did it past tense in support of Hillary Clinton, and I was also in support of President Obama. So that is fact, and I will accept that. But the op-ed that we wrote was not a political event. That was not a in support of Democrats as opposed to against Republicans. That is an acknowledgement that we have a problem, and how serious the problem is can be debated. But again, I go back to, it is not unreasonable to consider the possibility that a substantial number of active duty military may be confused by the Stop the Steal movement and question who is the actual president of the United States. We've got that confusion right now in millions of Americans.
The fact in 2024, if there is a Trumpian candidate or Trump himself runs again, how are you afraid that things could unfold?
The attempt to create alternate slates in this last election is going to play out in the future. That's not a one-time deal. And enough Republicans are acting on that in placement of people who will not stand up to the shenanigans of manipulating votes and manipulating electoral slates for the Electoral College. If enough doubt is applied to our electoral process, our democracy is at risk. That doubt that is in a great number of Americans today can slide into our active force. And if you have a reasonable young man or woman who now believes that we have doubt in who the real elected president of the United States is, who has doubt that we have made an accurate call, who believes there may be fraud in the electoral outcome, that doubt will be a significant problem for the country, for our federal police forces, for all of our state and local police forces, and by extrapolation, the U.S. military.
So when it comes to the military and addressing this, wargaming is something you suggest that could be done. What else should be done to try and cope with this problem now, before the next election?
We need to work on the moral component. We no longer need to accept as an article of faith that our 18-year-old is coming out of high school, or the 20-year-old coming out of some level of college education, or the 22-year-old coming out of university, that they have an absolute faith in the American political system, the American electoral system, and the Constitution of the United States. That has been challenged by the likes of Fox News, by the likes of other right-wing conservative news outlets, and by the Republican Party and their leaders in the House, and to a degree, their leaders in the Senate.
So how do you address it?
That's the challenge. We're going to have to work very hard on making sure that each and every one of our young men and women have a civics foundation. And where we expected our education system to provide that, I no longer believe that that's true.
But if you provide it to them when they enlist at 18, 20, 22, is it too late? Have their political views already been shaped?
That is a great question. And I don't believe that an 18-year-old, 20-year-old, or 22-year-old is intellectually set for life. I am an excellent example, me personally. I was extremely conservative when I came into our armed forces at the age of 22. I have evolved, took a while, but I have evolved to be pretty much centrist. And I expect that an 18-year-old is still, we have an opportunity to help shape his or her outlook.
So you also mentioned in your op-ed that the military should be utilizing its intelligence capabilities to figure out what's happening within the force. That sounds like a potentially slippery slope.
It is. When you sign your name and take the oath to come into the military, you do give up certain rights. I was at a venue on a federal installation where somebody was flying a flag, "Let's go, Brandon." That's a violation of the Hatch Act. But the defense of the person was freedom of speech. Well, you don't have freedom of speech in the U.S. military. And that's just part of a 1939 law called the Hatch Act.
The Department of Defense has now come up with some suggestions on how it may address extremism in the military, and social media is part of that. And they say they're going to look more carefully at recruits as they come in. Do you think they can ever get the visibility they need to figure out whether somebody is an extremist or not, given how many layers there are to the internet? Somebody might not put something on their Facebook page, but they could be participating in some subterranean chat room.
Yes. Again, we're always behind technology in the application of our laws and the development of our laws. And what you bring up is very complex. We're at the beginning of trying to understand the nature of the problem.
Here's another question for you. At that point, somebody is not signed on the dotted line. They have not enlisted. They are being looked at as a potential recruit. They still have free speech rights at that point, don't they?
They do. And if you, you know, they're part of the employment drill that folks go through right now, if they're looking to get a job, you put down what you are doing on what outlet. So if you're on Twitter or if you're on Facebook, your prospective employer has a right to go in there and find out if you're the kind of guy he wants.
Even if the prospective employer is the U.S. government, are there restrictions on what the military can do in terms of looking at someone's social media profiles?
I don't know. They're trying to figure that out. And good men and women are going to sort all this out because they have to.
Overall, what did you think of the Pentagon's proposals on this?
It's a start.
But only a start?
It's a start. And, you know, are you allowed to be on the rolls of the Proud Boys, yet you are not authorized to participate in their activities? Question mark. Can you contribute to the Proud Boys if you are an active duty soldier? All these are questions that they are working. You know, again, good people are trying to figure out what the answers to those questions are, because you do not wish to insert doubt into the loyalty to what entity for any soldier. This whole business of loyalty to the chain of command can be placed in doubt, and it's not something that we ever want to see.
Talking for a bit more about the speech aspect of this, my presumption is what you're really concerned about isn't the speech, it's the action and what people might do. In the case of Nidal Hassan, this was someone who said things that were of concern. He was raising red flags, but nobody expected he was going to pull out a gun at Fort Hood and kill 13 people. How do you ever know where the line is, where someone's going to cross over from just expressing support for certain ideas and acting on them?
Hassan is a example of a failure on the part of the chain of command. Every staff sergeant, squad leader of an infantry nine-man squad is intimately aware of his men. He knows them very well. And if they have problems, or if they have a failure to understand, the squad leader will know. This major had a very vivid trail that should have caused his chain of command to say, we have a problem here. And that was, to me, my understanding, that was a breakdown of the chain of command.
So it failed there, but it could fail in the case of somebody who held extremist views as well, couldn't it?
Indeed, and that's one of the prescriptions in this op-ed is get to know your troops and make sure that you understand.
But what if you agree with your troops?
Well, if you agree with your troops, then there is somebody above you who should know better.
But don't ask, don't tell was problematic, in part because people in command didn't embrace it. And the U.S. military still has not been able to root out sexual assault and sexual harassment. So why should we think they'll be able to get to the bottom of extremism in the ranks?
Well, you know, I hate to give this answer, but feel free to work harder. And it is this business of sexual assault in the military, again, we draw from the society at large, and sexual assault is an American problem. It's a human problem.
As is extremism.
Indeed. And we're flagging to the executive branch that we need to address this business a bit more rigorously.
Another problem is people who are retiring from the military, who are being actively recruited by some of the extremist groups. What can be done? What should be done with them?
Well, when you retire from the military and you're drawing a pension, you are still subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You are eligible to be brought back, and if you are in violation of the of the UCMJ, well, that's a problem for you. It's the non-retired veterans who are free agents. They can be radicalized.
And should the military be trying to do about that, if anything?
I am having right now a failure of imagination on how to answer your question. It's a very hard question to answer. What can Americans do to modify behaviors of veterans of the armed forces who have a lot of skills that we saw deployed at the 6th January insurrection? So it is a dilemma, and I don't have a good answer for that.
Let's go back to the big picture. How dire is this situation in your view?
There's a saying, you might be a bigot, but you will not behave as a bigot when you're in the U.S. military. We modify behaviors. Modification of thought is always a challenge.
That was Paul D. Eaton, retired U.S. Army Major General who spent more than 30 years in the military. He is now a senior advisor to Vote Vets. I asked him, by the way, if he'd gotten a lot of negative reaction to the op-ed. He said no. And that's it for this edition of Spy Talk. I'm Jean Meserve. Jeff Stein will be back with me next week. A reminder to subscribe to the Spy Talk podcast and Substack and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jean Meserve. Jeff is at Spy Talker. Have a great week. Talk to you next year.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole. MSW Media.